Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Bridget Bergen from the WNYC and Gothamist Newsroom, filling in for Brian today. 10 years ago, in the aftermath of the horrific mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, I was in Newtown, Connecticut, reporting for WNYC and NPR. I met a high school social studies teacher who lived in the community, and he told me about his experience in his classroom in nearby Fairfield, Connecticut, the day of the shooting, learning about the events as they were unfolding that Friday, and how he planned to talk with his students when they all returned to class on Monday. He knew they would have questions. Teachers and other school staff members, we are so grateful to you for all you do and all that you've gone through. And we just want to acknowledge that this is hard for you too, because here we are again, with children, parents, and teachers grappling with how to talk about the latest mass shooting, this time at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, and less than 2 weeks after another mass shooting closer to home in Buffalo. Joining me now to offer some guidance on how to have those tough conversations is Dr. Christina Chester, a school psychologist who works with the National Association of School Psychologists on school crisis prevention and response. She works in the Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland, the 15th largest school district in the nation. Dr. Chester, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want to know, what kind of conversations are you having with the children in your life about these latest events? Have you talked about the mass shooting in Buffalo, only to have another conversation 10 days later about Uvalde, Texas? Are your kids asking questions about what happened? And how are you deciding what and how much to tell them? If there happen to be any teachers who are out there who can speak to what their classroom was like yesterday, or maybe if you're listening on your break today, let us know. Or do you have a question for Dr. Chester about how to talk about these issues? Call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Dr. Chester, as a school psychologist, after a traumatic event like the one in Uvalde or in Buffalo, how does it change the school environment, even for those geographically removed from the events, particularly for the kids?
Well, events like this can definitely have a psychological impact on our students and our staff, as you so eloquently mentioned earlier. And that, you know, they start to question, you know, are schools safe? Is my work environment safe? Is this going to happen to me? And there can be lots of anxiety and fear when they hear about things like this. But, you know, as we were talking about, like, one of the things is we want to make sure that, you know, for the listeners and our families and our staff members out there, you know, trying to make sure to reassure to our students that schools are safe, that they are safe, you know, but also validate their feelings around what's going on and help to try to talk with them around what they are experiencing at that moment.
We're still very much in the early days after this mass casualty event. And now, beyond the scale of the tragedy, we're starting to see the faces of the kids and the teachers who were killed. It's hard to see. What kind of guidance do you offer to parents and teachers for how to communicate to kids now at this stage in the immediate aftermath?
Try to help students to know that while we live in this age where they have access to the news, to media 24 hours a day, and that they can go on social media, traditional media. Even this morning, I was looking at the pictures that were posted about the staff and the students there who were killed in Uvalde. And it's emotional. And so what can we do to help our kids to know that, you know, you may not want to look at these pictures. You may not want to go on and read about these events because we know that it does have an emotional impact on them. It is. And for those who have recently experienced other types of traumatic events, it can re-trigger them. So, and for our families, like if you're watching the news and you have young children who are there with you, you may not want to watch the news at that moment. Now, is it possible to DVR it or watch it on YouTube or another platform later once they've gone to bed? Because we know that the adults want to know what's going on, but it might not be the best time at this moment to watch it with your children.
When in these past few days, we've seen, I think, a lot written about how to talk to children about mass shootings. But as an expert, I'm hoping you could walk us through some pointers. First, in terms of how do you adjust what you say based on the children's age or grade level? I've read some experts say that if a child, for example, is under 8 years old and is unlikely to hear about this from someone else, then perhaps you don't need to talk about it at all. What's your perspective on that?
No, and that's very true. And so for students who are, let's say, like an early elementary school, like you said, 8 years old or third grade or younger, you know, if they don't know about it, it's okay not to share. You know, it's okay for them to be, you know, naive around what's going on in the world and let them continue to, you know, be in their childhood lives and not have to know about such horrific things. But if they do become aware of it, let's say if kids are talking about it in the playground or at lunch or, you know, to hear about these things, you know, making sure that our explanations are brief, they have a good balance of reassurances that their school, their homes are safe and the adults are there to protect them, you know, and also give them examples of what their schools are doing in order to maintain safety there as well. Even reminding them about like the lockdown drills that they do in school that are required. And then for the older kids, they're going to have a different type of conversation with them.
And you know, how do you start that conversation, particularly since, you know, I've read, you know, if you start talking, if you focus the conversation on feelings, that might be one of the ways that you could shut down an older child who you're talking to about this kind of incident.
Well, older kids, you know, they're going to be more vocal about, you know, what they've heard, how they're feeling, and, you know, what is going to be done about it, especially as you get the kids who are in middle school and high school who are starting to have those conversations around civics, around politics, so forth. And they may be very vocal about what, how they feel and what should happen. And it's okay to make that time to talk to them, have those conversations, hear what they have to say, hear what their friends are saying or what their friends in school and online are sharing around what's going on. But again, with them, you're still going to reassure that schools are safe, you know, and especially for like some of the kids, let's say fourth, fifth, sixth grade, going in and just trying to make sure that we are differentiating, like what's the reality versus, you know, fantasies or exaggerations about what's happened, what actually occurred. Mm-hmm. Kids that are in high school, older kids like seventh, eighth grade and middle school, you know, what are the roles that they, the students, can play in order to maintain safety in their schools? So let's say if they hear about a threat on social media, how can they share that information? Because we know that in many of these situations, people do make these threats on social media before they go forth and carry this out. What is their role in order to maintain the safety in their schools and at home?
This sort of gets back to, I think, part of what you were talking about before, and one of the recommendations from your organization, which is to reaffirm the safety in school. But I'm wondering, to what extent, how do you balance that guidance with the reality that you can't guarantee that nothing bad will ever happen again?
Right. And we can't, like you say, we can't say, you know, oh, this will never happen here, because, well, we can't, you know, guarantee that. That's not a guarantee in life that any of us can make. All we can do is say, these are the things that we're doing to maintain the safety at home and at school. We do drills. We make sure that the doors are locked. We don't let strangers into the building. All the things that they can do, we are doing as the adults in order to maintain the safety that's there. And just constantly reassuring them about, you know, the concepts around like those physical safety concepts, but also the psychological safety concepts. I know there's a lot of conversations around mental health and that what are we doing to provide mental health support for students in our schools? You know, if you know of somebody who's having concerns, how do you report it? Do you have a tip line in your school system that shares about information or that people can anonymously report things if they're concerned about being thought of as like a tattletale? So what are the things, specific things that are happening in your community that help all of our students and our staff members maintain safety there?
You're listening to The Brian Lehr Show. I'm Bridget Bergen, filling in for Brian today. I'm speaking with Dr. Christina Chester, a school psychologist from Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland, on how to talk to kids and support educators when it comes to the events we saw in Uvalde, Texas, and Buffalo. And we invite you to join this conversation. What kind of conversations are you having with the children in your life about the latest events? Or do you have a question for Dr. Chester about how to talk about these issues? Call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehr. Dr. Chester, you know, the shooting in Texas, many of the people who were killed were Latino. In Buffalo, the killer targeted Black victims in a racist attack. How do you help children and families process that additional trauma when they identify with the victims, when they see something like this targeting their community, and they're trying to understand why these individuals were targeted?
Oh, absolutely. And that's an excellent question, because we understand that incidents of racism by itself is highly traumatic on individuals of color and other marginalized communities. And when, you know, especially for the community in Buffalo, when they see that another community of color in Texas has now been a target of a mass casualty event, that can just re-trigger everything that just occurred to them. And so especially for communities of color and for other individuals who are allies and support, you know, communities of color and staff and students of color in their schools and workplaces and so forth, is something to be aware of, that this could have a particularly like an additional triggering response on them because of what just occurred, and that they are, here it is, another community of color that has been a target of mass violence here in our country. And so that is something that we have to pay particularly close attention to in making sure that, you know, they are okay, because there's a strong possibility at this moment they may not be, and that this may have an additional traumatic response for them.
And so keeping that in mind, as you know, as parents and teachers are trying to process these events themselves and help the children in their lives process them, what kind of signs and behaviors should they be alert to when monitoring the emotional state of a child?
Yes. And so if you see that, you know, because again, not all kids can express their feelings verbally, you know, so you may see changes in their behavior. So maybe if they're a kid who's normally really positive and easygoing, and all of a sudden they have a change of behavior where they're, you know, feeling really negative, or they're angry, or they're withdrawn, not paying attention at home. Maybe they're having trouble sleeping, or they're having nightmares. They may have trouble eating. Maybe they want to, you know, they're coming up to you and they're even more clingy than what they normally may be. If they're really young, you might see some developmental milestones that might not be happening now, like potty training, or, you know, maybe they're wetting the bed at night. And so just looking for changes in their normal behavior, that's an indication that even though they may not be able to express that I'm feeling this way, it may show that something is going on and that I am having a reaction to the events in my environment.
Let's go to one of our callers, Lisa in Forest Hills. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Bridget. Thank you so much for taking my call. And thank you for having this guest, Dr. Chester. You bring up so many good points. It's really, I wish everybody could hear this. So I'm 56, and when I was a school-age person, I wouldn't see stuff like this all over the media, because it was a different world, right? So I'm curious, I mean, I understand that we want to get the information out there and there's almost no way to avoid seeing it, but and this is like maybe a too idealistic of a point, but people like you, Dr. Chester, is there a way to impress upon the media to find a balance of how much of this to, you know, in effect, advertise this kind of thing, if you know what I'm saying? And I, like I say, maybe this is too idealistic of a point, but I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on that, or if there's any talk in your community as a doctor about that.
Thanks, Lisa, for that question. And Dr. Chester, I was looking at some of the guidance that NASP, your organization, puts out, and there are some very specific suggestions to schools about how to manage the media. So that's one side of the equation that Lisa's talking about. But then, of course, the other side of it is, you know, the proliferation of all this information. So maybe you can speak to both of those points.
Oh, yes. And we, organizations like mine, mental health organizations around the country, we do try to work with our media partners around how this information is brought forth to the public and trying to give them best practices for reporting. I know we've done really excellent jobs, especially when it comes to issues around death by suicide. And there's been a lot of changes in how that information gets reported over the past decade. When it comes to events like this and they become what's called newsworthy, then it's kind of like you're in this 24-hour news cycle and everybody is reporting it and everybody then goes online because you have the traditional media who follows one set of rules, but then you also have people online who aren't part of those normal processes and they kind of do whatever they want. And so it's hard. And so what we try to do is try to talk to the consumer and say, we know that all this is out there, and it's really hard trying to find that balance between what information must go out so people are aware, and then you don't get inundated with it so much that it starts to what we call like vicarious trauma by watching so much media around the situation. And so that's why we really try to encourage folks to limit the amount of television or social media or other means like watching videos online about the incident, because we know that it can have a negative impact on people. And so it does come to a place where we try to balance talking to our media partners around some of this, but then also talking to the consumers of that media to say, hey, you know, it's one thing to watch it for a day, but you may not want to watch it every day, all day, because it may have a negative impact on you.
Thank you so much for that, Dr. Chester. I have to do a station ID, so pardon me for one moment. I'm Bridget Bergen from the WNYC and Gothamist Newsroom, filling in for Brian Lehr. And this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. This is New York and New Jersey Public Radio. And we're talking with Dr. Christina Chester, a school psychologist with the National Association of School Psychologists, and she works in the Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland, talking about how to talk to kids about trauma, particularly in the wake of these recent mass shootings. Let's go to Jesse in Park Slope. Jesse, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. And really, thanks so much for having this conversation. It's someone that so many parents need to hear right now.
And what, do you have a question for Dr. Chester, or are you have you had a conversation with your children?
Yes, I am struggling with that conversation now. I have two children in elementary school in Park Slope, Gowanus, and they've actually had two active shooter scenarios just during COVID alone. And I'm trying to figure out how to reassure them that they're safe in school when there have actually been shooters around their school building, and they've been in lockdown for a full day twice now, just during, you know, an already anxious time during COVID.
Jesse, I'm so sorry to hear that. And were those false alarms, or were they actual incidents? Do you know?
No, unfortunately, they were actual incidences. The subway shooting was two stops down from their school. And then there was another incident where someone had a gun in the area, as well as doing drills, and they've also had to do an evacuation. So they've had a lot of exposure to this, and I'm just trying to figure out, both my second and fourth graders want to know, well, if people are getting close to school with guns, what's to say they're not going to then be in school? And I'm just struggling for something that will reassure them.
Dr. Chester, do you have any advice for Jesse?
No, and again, I'm sorry to hear about these incidents that have occurred within close proximity to your kids' schools. And I understand just how scary that may be for kids, especially then you see this going on and then it reminds them of these instances that have occurred during this period of time. And just to remind them about, like, so what are the things that were done in order to maintain their safety in the school? So when they went on lockdown, what are the procedures that they followed? And how did the school, you know, like, work with the local law enforcement around making sure that, you know, individuals who were in the community didn't come, you know, onto school grounds, and that what they did in order to maintain the safety in the schools. And while, yes, you know, sitting there and being fearful about this and seeing like, oh my goodness, well, this happened really close and it could have happened to us, but if this has, you know, come onto our campus, you know, can definitely, you know, ring in the minds of the students and the staff in the school. Mm. But just trying to remind them that, you know, you were safe, there were procedures that were put in place, and just constantly reassure them, you know, around that, you know, these are the things that are happening. You are safe. This didn't occur here. And that the school will, you know, continue to put things in place and look at things and look at the safety procedures in order to make sure that, you know, all the students in the school remain safe.
Thank you, Dr. Chester. And Jesse, go ahead. Oh, Jesse, I'm sorry, we cut Jesse off there. Sorry, Jesse, what was your follow-up?
I just wanted to say that at the time that we had each of these incidences, the school did a wonderful job making the kids feel safe because they had drills. They really, they weren't anxious at those times. It was purely, you know, with this actual shooting, you know, of children their age, that the extra anxiety came up. So thank you so much for that advice.
Jesse, thanks so much for calling in, and thanks for letting us know that there was some reassurance that came with, you know, in addition to the trauma that your kids went through, that they did get a sense that the school had things under control. I think that's important for our listeners to know. Let's go to Sarah in Brooklyn. Sarah, what's your question or comment for Dr. Chester?
Hi. So my seven-year-old, she's in second grade, and when she learned about the shooting in Uvalde, she had this lighthearted curiosity, I would say, about it. She was very curious about the specifics of, like, where was the classroom located in the school? How many teachers were in the class? How many students were in the class? Was it multiple classrooms? And, you know, were there windows? I'm kind of curious about sort of how to understand what's going on with that level of curiosity, and whether or not sort of how to direct the conversation and how frank to be with her about details.
Sarah, thank you for that question. Dr. Chester, you know, kids and their curiosities are things I think we as parents are often confounded by. Do you have any advice for how to answer these types of questions?
Right. And yes, kids are very curious. I have a 12-year-old myself who asks lots of questions when these incidents are occurring around the country and in our community, too. And, you know, I would say, especially for younger kids, it's okay to not give them some of the details that they want to know. I mean, because some of it is like, okay, you know, curiosity, some of it you may not know at the time, like especially if they asked early on, a lot of those details weren't available. They were still conducting their investigation. I mean, like now we know the shooting happened in one classroom. And it's okay to say, you know, I don't know. The police are still looking at it. They're still doing their investigation. But especially at that age. I mean, I have, when going in and doing crisis response in elementary schools, I would say that my second, third grade classrooms probably give me the most questions around what's happened. They have lots of questions and they feed off of each other. So what can we do in order to, you know, be able to answer them as briefly as possible, but without giving too much details that may be scary or may cause them to have bad dreams or other negative feelings around what's occurred. So, because they are curious, and it's okay to say that you don't know. And if it's something that you feel might scare them, it's okay not to share it with them. Because just because they ask doesn't mean at that time, especially at that age level, that they really have a need to know.
Sarah, I hope that helps. I have a curious young one too, who can ask a whole list of questions, and it's can be challenging to figure out how much and what exactly to say in those responses. But thank you for your call and thank you for your question. Dr. Chester, the National Association of School Psychologists lays out a pretty long timeline for how schools can recover from tragedies like this one. We know that the conversations teachers, students, and parents have today and this week are going to change over time. What are some things that can help kids and, frankly, the educators in the building regain a sense of normalcy, and how much time does that take?
Right. And for some, depending on an incident, it can take months, others, it can take years. And so they're at the, unfortunately, with these incidents, like they're at the beginning of recovery. They're in right now what we call like short-term recovery, and it will continue into long-term recovery over some time. And so, and there'll be incidents that occur, let's say like the anniversary of the event in a year, that will come about and re-trigger feelings and emotions about what's happened. And so we try to tell folks, you know, try to maintain a sense of normalcy in your normal routine as much as possible. And we know it's hard. I mean, because right now they're going into the summer. And so, you know, but what can the schools do in order to try to maintain a sense of community, to maintain for students and staff to be able to continue to come together, talk to each other around what's going on? And having, you know, events that helps to bring them together that are intentional, to allow them opportunities to bond. The community will come together and bring lots of resources and help. There'll be tons of volunteers from all over that community that's going to come in and want to do things for them. And so, you know, and as you're going through and trying to figure out, you know, all these things and what resources we need and support that's there, you know, but eventually as you go on like 3-4 months from now, those things may go away. And so, but what can a community still do in order to maintain a sense that they're united, to continue to build upon resiliency from what's happened, and the community coming together and figure out what are the things that they need? What are the things that can continue in order to, you know, rebuild trust, rebuild a sense of safety around this for the staff and students of that school and that community, to help them to make sense of what's happened and to help them to, you know, kind of stay together and be united through this horrific time.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now. Thank you, Dr. Christina Chester, a school psychologist with the National Association of School Psychologists, who works on crisis prevention and response. She's from the Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.